conflicts as various nations and power groups struggle for supremacy over this new world government, and how everybody else in the entire world seems to know what's going on except the American citizens, who have been kept in the dark. Now, one of the things that has made me extremely successful, and one in which the New Agers, the globalists, do not want to touch or argue with from the standpoint of trying to prove me wrong, is that I use their own documents against them. Hence, we will be using a lot of overheads tonight that I take direct quotes out of what different globalists have said, or United Nations documentation, or United States documentation, to show you step by step what has been actually happening, where we are today, and where we're likely to be in the near future. So without further ado, let's go ahead and get started so that we don't go into the wee hours of the morning. And I want to start with something that was happening way back in the creation of the United Nations. The United Nations, when it was sold to the American people back in 1945, we were told basically that there was no intention on the part of any of the leadership in the world to make the United Nations into a world government. Well, that's not true. The following year, Assistant Secretary William Benton made a speech before UNESCO that was the first year of a UNESCO, in which he said, and I quote, "As long as a child breathes, the poisoned air of nationalism, education, and world-mindedness can produce only precarious results. As we have pointed out, it is frequently the family that infects the child with extreme nationalism. The school should therefore use the means described earlier to combat family attitudes that favor jingoism, or, as it's defined, nationalism, and we shall see presently recognize in nationalism the major obstacle to development of world-mindedness. We are at the beginning of a long process of breaking down the walls of national sovereignty. UNESCO must be the pioneer." That was 54 years ago, and we're almost there now. Perhaps by the end of the year 2001, we will have a world government. Now, it may not happen that soon, and we'll discuss the ins and outs and the ramifications of what's liable to happen a little bit later on in my discussion. One of the things that we need to recognize as to how this is being done. And the best, most succinct diagram or illustration of this that I could find comes from a man by the name of Professor Carol Quigley, who was a Harvard economist, who also a historian, and also was at George Washington University. Is that right? That seems wrong for some reason. Georgetown University, thank you. In Washington, D.C., where he taught William Jefferson Clinton. During the 1950s and the 1960s, Professor Carol Quigley had an inside track within the international community in which he tracked, he communicated, they accepted him as one of their own, and he studied from a historical standpoint the ins and outs and nuances of what this group of people were attempting to do. And he wrote a book then that was published in 1966 called Tragedy and Hope. Some of you may have a copy of this. It's about that thick. It's over 6,000 pages long. It is literally a in-detail description of every action and what they're planning on doing. That book lasted for 1 week on the shelves before he was forced to remove it. And obviously, because it was a week on the shelves, there were copies made, and it's been reprinted since, so it is available still. And one of the paragraphs, I think, that was taken out of this, I have not read the entire book, obviously, but it is a tremendous reading source if you have the time, have a few spare hours, just to pick it up anywhere and start reading what these globalists are attempting to do. And this one paragraph really describes, I believe, exactly what it is they're trying to do. He says that the global elite's aim is nothing less than to create a world system of financial control in private hands, to be able to dominate the political system of each country and the economy of the world as a whole. The system was to control in a feudalistic fashion by the central banks of the world acting in concert by secret agreements arrived at frequent and private meetings and conferences. And of course, that's still being done today. It's primarily through the financial community, the global financial community, primarily of the United States and Britain, that is advancing this world government, but also all of the European market, the European Union, as we'll see a little bit later on. The Council on Foreign Relations, many people think this is the boogeyman of the secret societies of the globalists. It's not. It's a front group. About 800 people belong to it. Mostly it's a good old boys club. However, there is a core at the center of the Council on Foreign Relations that is very active in promoting world government and is using the whole CFR apparatus, as it were, as a smokescreen. And they publish, usually in their publication called Foreign Affairs, those kinds of thinking that they're ready to institute in the world. And this one happens to be done in 1970, just 3 years after the publication of the Iron Mountain Report, which calls for, if we're going to create a world government, we can no longer use war as a mechanism to cause fear amongst populations and therefore allow us to control the behavior of populations through fear. We have to find an alternative, and the Iron Mountain Report, named after the first meeting held in Iron Mountain, New York, along the Hudson River, and those nuclear bunkers built into the mountainside there, where they actually have defined what it was that they wanted to substitute the threat of war for in order to be able to control populations. And they settled on, in 1967, in their publication called the Iron Mountain Report, the environmental holocaust. In 1970, 3 years after that publication, Foreign Relations began to publish a series of articles describing the ecological holocaust that was facing the world. And in this particular issue, the first issue done by George Kennan to prevent a world disaster, where it was summed up in 3 points, that the eco-crisis is a global threat so great that it endangers all of life on Earth. In other words, it's going to affect all of us if we don't do something about it. The crisis should be controlled by a partnership. Now, I want you to remember the word partnership, because the partnership is made up as an unholy triad between government and business, and today, non-governmental organizations. At the time this was written, non-governmental organizations did not exist. But now it's the unholy triad or unholy trinity made up of government, specifically the United Nations, business, and non-governmental organizations operating under a central international super agency. Now this will be a supranational EPA-like organization. You're going to see this. We're going to come back to it several times during the talk tonight, where these globalists want to establish an international EPA-like organization that can control literally every action that every single human being on planet Earth takes. Under a central international superagency to regulate the environmental issues, and finally, the new crusade must proceed at least to some extent at the expense of the immensely dangerous preoccupations that are now pursued under the heading of national defense. So they are substituting the environmental holocaust for the threat of war. Because lest we solve global warming, ozone depletion, biological diversity destruction, all of these different things, acid rain, we are going to destroy the Earth and us along with it. And we are the enemy. For those of you in the audience who are old enough, remember the old cartoon from Pogo, where he used to say on a frequent basis, we have met the enemy, and he is us. And this is exactly the plan that these globalists have put forth and has been in operation for the last 30-some-odd years. If you're still not convinced, the founder and current leader of the Club of Rome, which in fact is real, despite many years of efforts to try to say that it's nothing but a right-wing conspiracy to discredit the global community. Aurelia Pecci, who actually created the Club of Rome, and it's the inner circle of the global elitists in 1991, stated, that while searching for a new enemy to unite us, we came up with the idea that pollution, the threat of global warming, water shortages, famine, and the like would fit the bill. All of these dangers are caused by human intervention. The real enemy then is humanity itself. And as Pogo said, we have met the enemy, and he is us. And of course, this finds its way through international leadership, especially within the Clinton administration. In 1997, Bill Clinton addressed the General Assembly of the United Nations, in which he said that the forces of global integration. Now, what is global integration? Global integration is the process of bringing together the nations of the world into a world government. Now, they call it global governance. And they'll always refer to it as global governance and will adamantly deny that this is world government. But you cannot govern without government. It's impossible. Therefore, what we're seeing being instituted is an absolute totalitarian world government that they're planning for the world. Absolute. You take nothing away from here tonight, realize that we're looking at an absolute totalitarian government that they're trying to establish. We're not going to get into the heart of this. I did that 3 years ago when I was here, get that video, and I go into great detail explaining exactly the type of controls and the lack of controls and the lack of credibility and the lack of accountability to the people of the world that will make this a totalitarian government. So what Bill Clinton is saying, that the forces of global integration are a great tide, inexorably wearing away the established order of things. Now, what is the established order of things here in the United States? It's our U.S. Constitution, for instance. Our civil rights. The fact that we are a government of the people, by the people, and for the people. That's the established order of things. And, of course, they want to reverse this so that the people are merely tools of the state, where we revert to a statist type of government in which the state is all-powerful. Going on, he says that people are susceptible to the misguided protectionism, to the poisoned appeals of extreme nationalism, and the ethnic, racial, and religious hatred. New global environmental challenges require us to find a new strategy of security. This word of security is a very big word in their vocabulary. They use it to justify all kinds of things. Nations have begun to put that strategy into place through a new network of institutions and arrangements. Through this web of institutions and arrangements, nations are now setting the international ground rules for the 21st century, isolating those who challenge them from the outside, unquote. And folks, do you feel isolated? Well, you now know that it's by design. It's not accidental. I think you probably realized that before. But it is happening, and we are being isolated from telling our side of the story to the American people to help them understand and make adequate and righteous decisions when the opportunity presents itself. The question is then, how do they do it? How in the world are they getting this agenda from the international level down to the local level? Well, they've got a plan for that too. Now, on the environmental side, there's probably a number of different plans, but from the environmental side, you have an organization called the IUCN, the International Union for the Conservation of Nature. Been in existence since the United Nations was created. It's not part of the United Nations Charter. It's a scientific advisor to the United Nations. But through the IUCN, such programs as ecosystem management, American Heritage Rivers, the Clean Water Initiative, the Endangered Species Act, and all the rules and regulations of the EPA, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the U.S. Forest Service, the U.S. Park Service, and so forth, are directly related. We're going to explain how that happens in a few moments, but before we do, I want to determine, or I want you to understand, what the purpose of the IUCN is, or this International Union for the Conservation of Nature. The purpose is to promote an alternative model for sustainable communities and lifestyles. Yes, you heard it right. The whole concept of sustainable developments come right out of the IUCN. And it's all over America now. Based on eco-spiritual practice and wait a minute. Now, what is eco-spiritual practices and principles? Well, we're about to find out. Because it affects you in a very, very negative way.
To accelerate, as it says, this transition to a just and sustainable future, the problems that we face in the world today, humanity must undergo a radical change in its attitudes, values, and behavior. In response to this situation, a new global ethics is taking form and is finding its expression in international law.
How in the world are they able to get it into international law? Well, you're about to find out.
One last thing. These equal spiritual practices and principles, and according to the United IUCN, in a biocentric approach, this is what they call it, in a religious context, it's called pantheism, the belief that nature is God. But in a biocentric approach, says the IUCN, the rights of nature are defended first and foremost on the grounds of the intrinsic value of animals, plants, rivers, mountains, and ecosystems, rather than simply on the basis of the utilitarian value or benefit to human beings.
In other words, nature comes first. Nature's needs comes before man's needs. And we're going to see some very classic examples of that as we go through tonight's discussion. And one of the things that we told the Senate in August of 1994 was that this treaty had not been written, but was going to be dependent upon a base document written by the United Nations called the Global Biodiversity Assessment. The U.S. Senate called the United Nations and asked for the Global Biodiversity Assessment. It was supposed to be in draft form, only to be told by the United Nations they had no idea what the Senate was asking for. They had not authorized the writing of this document. They had bad information, go back and ratify our treaty. However, one of our men, there was four of us, one of the people knew somebody in New York that knew somebody in England that knew somebody in Germany that knew somebody else, and we finally got a copy. It was the chapter 10 of this document. It was 300 and some odd pages long. The final document in published form is 1,140 pages long. And we scanned this document. We found it to be the most anti-human document that we could possibly imagine. And again, I go into far more detail. If you look up on the previous visit that I made with you, I go into detail with this document. I'm only going to touch on some high points here tonight. But it breaks it up, their view of reality, as it were, into two worldviews in the world today. The first worldview is of the Western worldview. That's the one that we live in today. And they say that the Western worldview is characteristic of large-scale societies heavily dependent upon resources brought from considerable distances. It is a worldview that is characterized by the denial of the sacred attributes of nature. Whoa, now wait a minute. Denial of the sacred attributes of nature? This is out of a United Nations document. It goes on to say, which became firmly established about 2,000 years ago with the Judeo-Christian Islamic religious traditions. So it's direct aim at all monotheistic belief systems, especially that of Christianity. This is a United Nations document. It goes on page after page deriding Christianity as the primary source for all the evils done to the environment today. It does describe its own view of reality as this worldview. They call it the traditional worldview. And it says that the worldview of traditional societies tends to be strikingly different from the modern worldview. They tend to look at and view themselves as members of a community that not only includes other humans, but also plants and animals, as well as rocks. So now rocks are a member of your community that you have to share with. It goes on to say, even worse, people are then members of a community of beings, like human beings, living and non-living. So a rock is now elevated up to the status of a human being, and they are both equal in the eyes of this belief system. Now, many of us in this audience are probably Christians, and I do not want to say that we do not have a stewardship responsibility, because we do. But we should not ever hold up nature as being God, as they have done here, where a rock is equivalent to that of a human being. It concludes in this statement by saying, thus rivers may be viewed as mothers, animals may be treated as kin. Hence, we have the American Heritage Rivers Initiative,
initiated by Bill Clinton about 3 years ago. It goes on to say that for most of human existence, traditional societies lived in an ethical paradigm in which nature is valued both in its own right and as for its role in spirituality. In other words, it is God. Traditional societies have considered certain sites as sacred, where most human activities are prohibited. Remember this phrase. Traditional societies have considered certain sites as sacred, where most human activities are prohibited. That is the heart of the Convention on Biological Diversity. Locking up nearly 50% of the land area of the United States is their solution to protecting biological diversity, and we'll start to talk about that later. The quote goes on by saying, most societies have also considered certain species as sacred, or how these species are incarnations of, or in some ways associated with gods and deities, or how they have magical powers. Reincarnation is a major factor with many of these people, not all of them, but many of them. Hence, rocks will eventually incarnate into lower life forms, which will incarnate into animals and plants and so forth, which will eventually incarnate or evolve into human beings. Therefore, they have as much right as a human being. That's their logic. And unless you understand this, you will be totally buffaloed or baffled by why they do certain things and why they are so zealous in protecting things of nature. And again, I do not want to denigrate the concept of stewardship and the responsibility that each and every one of us have in protecting and respecting what God has created. This has led then to the Earth Charter. The Earth Charter was created by none other than Maurice Strong, whom we've already talked about, as well as Mikhail Gorbachev, the former premier of the Soviet Union. These two men got together in 1992, took what they believed out of the Earth Summit in Rio de Janeiro, and started to put together this Earth Charter. It was finally released this year in April, on April 15th. Now, the Earth Charter, according to Maurice Strong and Mikhail Gorbachev, in their writings, they say that a consensus has developed that the Earth Charter should be the articulation of a spiritual vision that reflects universal spiritual values, including but not limited to ethical values, a people's charter that serves as a universal code of conduct. Remember that. This is universal. Every one of us is going to have to subscribe to this particular concept. Universal code of conduct for ordinary citizens, educators, business executives, scientists, religious leaders, even the pastors of Christian churches will have to accept this new Earth-based ethic called the Earth Charter. Going on, Mikhail Gorbachev and Maurice Strong say that the Earth Charter initiative reflects the conviction that a radical change in humanity's attitudes and values is essential to achieve social, economic, and ecological well-being in the 21st century. The Commission plans to circulate the final version of the Charter as a people's treaty beginning in mid-1998. The Charter will be submitted to the United Nations General Assembly in the year 2000, which has been done. They are now considering the Earth Charter for ratification. And there is a treaty that's awaiting in the wings of the IUCN called the Covenant on the Environment and Development that, as soon as the United Nations accepts the Earth Charter, will be brought out as an international treaty for the nations to sign that will put into legal force the various provisions of this particular creed. This has real-world ramifications. The Bureau of Land Management, of which California has much, most of the eastern United States does not have any Bureau of Land Management land, but the western half of the United States does. In fact, the Bureau of Land Management controls most of western land. They came out in 1994, in March 30th of 94, with a plan called the Ecosystem Management. And in the chapter called the Human Dimensions of Ecosystem Management, the objective and purpose of that particular chapter states that all ecosystem management activities should consider human beings as a biological resource.
In other words, you and I are nothing more than biological resources for these elite people in the Bureau of Land Management to manage. We have no more value than the rocks and the trees that they also manage. This right out of a government document, and needless to say, we took this to the U.S. Congress, and it's created quite a stir back in 1994. That language is no longer in there. The very fact that it was shows the mentality of these people. And that mentality was brought out very clearly this past year, the great fire season of the year 2000, in which we literally saw nearly 7 million acres burn up, primarily in southern Idaho and Montana, but really all over the western United States. It was a bad fire year. We were going to have a lot of fires, a lot of major fires. The problem was that because of this belief system that permeates the U.S. Forest Service and the Bureau of Land Management now, many of these fires, the actual fire officials argued for as many as 3 days before they lifted the first shovel against those fires, whether or not they should send bulldozers in to build fire lines because they may rip out a plant or two of an endangered species. 3 days they waited. And of course, if any of you have had fire management experience, and I have, while I was working, I have my degree in forestry, and while I was working in my younger years, I fought many project fires, and I'm very familiar with how to fight fires, especially in that part of the country, because I had my education in the western part of the United States. This is not the way you fight a fire. You put crews in there immediately, and you start building fire lines to contain that fire when it's still just a few hundred acres. If you can control that fire in the first 5 or 6 hours, chances are you can keep it to several hundred acres. By arguing for 3 days whether or not they should build fire lines, whether or not they should use retardants, airplane dropped retardants, because some of those retardants may drift into streams and cause pollution in the streams, which could damage the aquatic life and some of the trout, the endangered trout, the bull trout. Meanwhile, while they're arguing about it, the fire advanced from several hundred acres to several thousand acres to 100,000 acres to 500,000 acres. The streams were boiled dry, the trout were killed, while they were back in the camp arguing whether or not they should be using these fire suppression techniques. This is the real world lunacy of this belief system. And I'm adamant about that word lunacy, because you can describe it in no other way. It is lunacy. And they want to run the world this way. We have to stop them. It means the demise of civilization as we know it. It's not hard to imagine that if you believe that humans are the cause of all the Earth's problems, that we're overpopulated. And indeed, this document, the Global Biodiversity Assessment, states that the population growth has exceeded the capacity of the Earth's biosphere to support us. They give two solutions, and only two, to this problem. The first is that it's estimated that an agricultural world in which most human beings are peasants should be able to support 5 to 7 billion people. Well, folks, we have 6 billion people right now. That means all of us in this room, or nearly all of us in this room, are going to have to become agrarian peasants if we use this solution. Do you want to become an agrarian peasant? Do you want to live in a metal shack someplace with a dirt floor, maybe a bed or two? You want to have them tell you how many kids you can have? Because this is exactly what they have in mind. This is their solution. This isn't mine. I didn't use the word peasants. They used the word peasants. Now, not too many of us are too wild about that particular option, are we? They give you a different option.
In contrast, they go on to say, a reasonable estimate for an industrialized world society at the present North American material standard of living would be 1 billion people.
So if we wanted to maintain our current standard of living, we would have to reduce the Earth's human population by somewhere around 70% in the next 30 to 50 years, according to this document. Those are the only two solutions that they provided, what they consider the over-human overpopulation. A reduction in the Earth's human population by about 70%. So 70% of us, or 7 out of 10 of us in this room, would have to offer ourselves up on the altar of nature in order to save planet Earth. It's lunacy. It's absolute lunacy. It's what's led Jacques Cousteau, the famous oceanographer, you've seen many of his programs on television, to tell UNESCO in 1993, about 3 years before he died, that the only hope of saving planet Earth is to eliminate 350,000 human beings a day. 350,000 human beings a day. He said, I don't like it, but that's the only solution. Why? It's the only solution to him because this is what he believes. Now, the United Nations was wise enough not to put in a method of how they're going to eliminate 70% of the Earth's human population in the next 30 to 50 years. That would have probably caused too many eyebrows to rise. But in a different part of the document, they gave a pretty good hint as to how they planned to do it. They go on in the agricultural section, he says that fertilizers have played an essential part in producing the world's harvest is undisputed. In other words, they're saying that the Green Revolution from the 1970s, 60s, and 70s that actually doubled, quadrupled, and so forth, food production that fed the world with an increasing population. Yes, we had starvation, but it wasn't because there wasn't enough food. It was because of poor distribution or more likely corrupt governments. They recognized that the Green Revolution solved the problem. But they go on to say, it is estimated that if the use of fertilizers ceased, the world's harvest would be cut almost in half. It goes on to say, however, the negative side of the equation is that nitrates from fertilizers seep into the groundwater, aquifers, and so forth, and therefore we must reduce or eliminate the use of fertilizers. Now, I realize there is a lot of good evidence to suggest that we just can't pour fertilizers on and expect to have the nutrition that we should have. I'm not going to get into that discussion tonight. The fact that I want to get into is the fact that they're willing to take a course of action that would reduce the world's food production by one half, in this case, probably more because they would also reduce the use of pesticides, knowing full well what would happen if they did that, that we would lose 50 to 60 to 70% of the Earth's human population in the next 30 to 50 years. It's astonishing. It literally is astonishing what this belief system will do to the mind of an otherwise normal thinking human being, willing to kill and subvert their fellow man for the good of their god, planet Earth, or the Greek goddess Gaia. They also discuss property rights in this particular document. They say that property rights are not absolute, they're not unchanging, they're not inalienable like our Constitution and the Declaration of Independence of the States. Rather, they are a complex, dynamic, and shifting relationship between two or more parties over space or time. In other words, whatever the United Nations says they are, whenever the United Nations wants to change the definition, you can continue to pay the taxes, but the United Nations is going to be able to tell you what you can and cannot do. This was reaffirmed as I was on the evening of the 29th of September 1994. We had gotten this document, FedEx to us. I'll explain how in a little while. But we had this document explained to, or FedEx to us, chapter 10, and we divided up the responsibility as who's going to read what. And I was reading very fast in this document, highlighting things I wanted the U.S. Senate to see. And I came across this statement right here. Property rights can still be allocated to the environmental public good, but in this case, they should be restricted to usufructual or usufructual. What in the world is usufructual? I had no idea. I thought it was a swear word. I had to go look it up in my dictionary, and the dictionary I used was a 1956 collegiate dictionary, Webster Dictionary. Shows you how old I am. And in that dictionary, I was stunned to read that the concept, it's not that way it's written, it's very much softened in today's dictionaries. You can still see it there, but it's not as clear-cut as the dictionary I used, and that basically said that the concept, the usufruct concept, was first developed by the Romans in the Roman Empire, and it means the Caesar owns everything. And he allocates out by right and privilege to those whom he wants the right to grow crops, the right to build a home, the right to build a business, whatever it is that these people want to do, you have to kowtow, you have to grovel before the local governor in order to be able to do that because he holds all the property rights. And this is the concept that the United Nations is advancing for the entire world to this treaty called the Convention on Biological Diversity. I'm going to shift away from that particular treaty and take a quick look at another treaty that you've been hearing a lot about.